Hi, it's Reina. I'm a TV chef, transcendental punk musician, neurobiologist, and radical self-love coach. And this is Creative Relationships. Creative Relationships is like On Being, but on acid and naked, covered in glitter in the jungle. This show is who the fuck knows what, but it's always insightful, deep, fresh, weird, fun, and exactly what the doctor didn't order. If your heart's beating but your soul's flatlining, grab your headphones, lace your sneakers up, and take a walk on the wild side of life. I'll see you inside. In this episode of Creative Relationships, I'm joined by my dear friend and celebrated academic, Dr. Kakoli Bhattacharya. We dive deep into the depths of internalized misogyny in Desi and diasporic women of the Indian subcontinent, uncovering the unconscious roots of why we continue to hurt each other instead of helping heal the collective. Important stuff with laugh breaks built in. Enjoy.
No. Hi, Bachu.
Hi, Seema Aunty. How are you?
Seema Aunty. Dude, I think I'm going to get t-shirts that just say, oh, Seema Aunty, and that will be my merch.
I have an idea for my merch. It's just so good.
What was your idea?
You cannot steal it, girl. It's my idea, though.
Do you ever think I would steal ideas? No. Am I ever short on ideas?
No, I know. And you totally honor the creatives in your life, so I know that you won't steal. Is this part going to be out in the world?
Yes. So don't say it now. If it is a thing, you can tell me later. We can talk about it later. It's okay.
Yes.
I'm sure it's amazing. I love that you're here, everyone. I just realized I did one episode recording right before this with someone else who is also a Dr. B. And you are also Dr. I have two Dr. B's in my life, one after the other.
I am Dr. Queen B. Let's get this right.
Okay, sorry. Yes. Everyone, this is Dr. Queen B. You want to introduce yourself?
Sure. So hi, everyone. Whoever is listening, viewing, people are viewing too?
Both. Yeah.
Both. Okay. So viewing, listening. I'm so happy to be here. Reina is a dear friend of mine, and my name is Kakoli Bhattacharya, but sometimes people call me Queen Bee, and I am an academic. I work in the field of qualitative research, and I work with graduate students, hopefully, who are trying to graduate with their dissertation and need help in setting up their research. And qualitative research, for people who are unfamiliar, is research that incorporates storytelling.
It was never told to me like this when I was briefly in grad school. Your explanation is so much more interesting.
Yes.
I would do it if you were teaching it like that.
I know. I'm kind of good at what I do.
I have heard. I have seen the evidence. I only have amazing people in my life at this point, my dear. Awesome. So I have surrounded myself with an increasingly high level of high, not in like, in a hierarchy sense, just in an energetic sense, like I want good people around me, and y'all are everywhere. I love it. You have so many big, deep, interesting, insightful thoughts, and I don't know which one is popping out to me right now, but I'm going to go with asking you your thoughts on Desi-specific internalized misogyny.
Oh.
And not to put you on the spot, but yes, to put you on the spot, but I think this is something you and I can speak to a lot. Would that be?
Yeah, no, that's
you see for you? How does that feel? I don't know if we talked about what we're going to do.
We did not talk about it. So I am improvising. Yeah. We have not talked about anything. We have not rehearsed anything. We are totally improvising here.
I mean, you know, that's what I do. So
I know.
This is all improv.
And it's all right. It's okay. Yeah. It's totally okay with me. Well, you know, I literally made a commitment of my life to study like how they see diasporic identities unfold. And especially for women, And I do it from, you know, a feminist perspective, a transnational feminist perspective, which just means that people who have multiple connections to different nations. So then they're from here, there, and not really fully from here, not really fully from there, and kind of exist in a middle third place, a liminal third place. So it's been interesting watching women talk about their lives in relationship to family, parents, spouses, and I'm part of a couple of Desi groups where there are Desi girls that are talking about their experiences in their family units. And often those experiences are super violent and aggressive. And what is really sad sometimes to witness this is that these are sort of, you know, the younger generation of Desi parents that, you know, are either in my generation or even a generation after me, and their children are experiencing a lot of the same things that I experienced, or perhaps maybe you experienced. And so it has occurred to me that we are transmitting this intergenerational pain down the line and normalizing it. And so the misogyny, I would say that on one hand, we're telling our girls, like, yes, go to school, yes, get educated, yes, do whatever. But at the end, like, just become whatever the men want you to be. So that means, like, become the housewife, become the educated maid, you know, so you do all the work in the house, but you also bring in the money too, because we live in a capitalist society. And now that we have invested this much money in you to go this much further in education, now there's a capitalist economic value of women's labor in these relationships. Mm-hmm. You know? And so they bring that labor, that are labor at home, reproductive labor and domestic labor, and then everything else. Now, if you live in India, you can maybe get some relief by getting household help, but still your time, energy, attention is to managing that too. Mm-hmm. And so I think men are super confused, because on one hand, they go to school with women that are super, you know, independent and probably kicking their butts in tests and exams and other things, extracurricular activities, but somehow they're programmed to think like, okay, that's great, but that's not what I can marry. Like, I need to marry somebody who looks like my mother. And so I need to marry that version of a woman. And then yet women are being trained to think in terms of like, you can do whatever you want to do. And I'm talking in the more urban centers of Desi people, but then, you know, go marry this stranger. Most of the marriages still are like a semi-arranged setup scenarios. So they'll go marry these strangers and then do life according to their expectations, you know? And so I think that the fabric of patriarchy and misogyny are so entangled and normalized that I see that played out in these various young people's lives, and it's super sad to witness it, super sad. Mm-hmm.
I'm curious too, like, do you see, I started noticing this too, how we Desi women, the internalized part is that we cancel each other and we badmouth and judge and criticize and squash and put down and eliminate and marginalize each other.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's the piece where it's like, we feel threatened. I don't, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, in my community, in Bengali community, we call it like, we have a whole term for it. That discourse of gossiping and trashing each other is called PNPC, which is Poro Ninda, Poro Chorcha. So you do like, Ninda is like, you know, you talk trash, and Poro Chorcha is like analysis of the trash that you have talked. But Poro means other. You talk trash about other, you know, like par, you know, in Hindi.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh, like Pardesi, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Like Pardesi, exactly. Uh-huh. Oroninda Porochorcha. And I have witnessed it in so many spaces. I've seen it in like second and third generation people as well. It's really toxic. It's really toxic to hold everybody in so much judgment. Mm-hmm. So much judgment, which just means that you're holding yourself in that much judgment too.
Mm-hmm.
which just means you're living in your body and your spirit and your mind, like fragmented into these little bits. And you're like, every bit is like ready to fight and judge each other. Yeah. And in so much chaos and lack of peace and serenity within you that you are motivated to now spill it out because it's too much and the excess of it has to go somewhere. So it gets projected out to whoever is in your orbit at that point in time. So yeah, so it's super hard. And I think sometimes for Desi women too, so I have a lot of Desi women now drawn to me to work with me. And my only thing is that you're going to have to understand my feedback as lovely act of love. And I don't know if you know that. And I don't know what programming you have prior to this point that tells you that critical responses from Desi women is not good or triggering. And I've had a lot of Desi women students say, yes, this brings up stuff. It brings up stuff because having critical feedback from older women has, you know, some sort of story they have that gets activated in their mind. And usually the story is, I'm not enough, I'm not good, I'm not this, I can't get your approval. So they're still seeking approval. So they have fear of rejection, you know, abandonment and all of those things that pop up. So, you know, half the time when I'm working with people, I have to work with these energies to make sure that we talk about it, we give them space to breathe, we don't demonize it or shame it or guilt somebody for feeling that. But then we have to forge a path together to say, what does a healing engagement look like for us? What does a supportive engagement look like for us? And it takes time. It has taken some people a good amount of time to trust that if I'm asking you to do something differently, I am doing that because I'm pouring my love into you. You know, I'm pouring my love into your work and I'm pouring my best intellectual, emotional, spiritual gift into your work. And also I see your potential much more than you can see it. So I want to hold that vision and that space for you to help you move to a more fuller version of you, you know, if that's the journey you want to go on with me, yeah, of course, you know.
And I can imagine how if they have had similar words like that told to them, but from a not good place, right? I just want the best for you, like, or how love and violence become conflated, right? Yeah. I would, you know, I wish I didn't have to do this to you either, right? Yeah. Like this kind of, this is like violent language culture, domestic violence culture, right? So those words and those actions, right? It can trigger a lot in somebody, like, wait, I'm hearing the same thing. And because the trust has been broken so long ago and those wounds are very deep. So it can be very difficult and scary and lonely and terrifying for someone to say, I'm going to open myself to someone again, ever. Because it's a very intimate, trust is the most, to me, it's like the most intimate relationship emotion, you know? Yeah.
No, for sure, for sure. I mean, anybody who, and a lot of Desi kids have gone through very much of a distorted version of love, you know, the love has been, and that's because their parents had gone through a distorted version and their parents and their parents and their parents, not to say everybody's life is like that, you know, but enough is that way that it's, some of this stuff gets normalized. Physical violence, emotional violence, spiritual violence has been normalized in different ways. And in people who I'm connected to, you know, and then the group that I'm in, it's every day there's like so many people talking about it. So yes, when somebody treats you poorly and then they say, this is for your own good, you know, this is for your own good. You just don't see it yet. You know, don't question me. I already have your best interest. You know, it hurts me more. You know, you are putting me in this inconvenience of hurting you because I'm hurting more to do all of this to you, you know. And so many Desi kids grow up without a sense of self and agency because they are existing to not unsettle the balance of their dynamics within their family, community, relationships and everything. And it's not until later they get married, they have divorces, you know, and then God forbid if they try to marry outside their familial expectation, and then let's say they discard religious beliefs, or let's say they decide to come out as queer or anything else. You know, all of those things compound to the cis heteronormative patriarchal stuff that we have normalized, and everything else is the deviant, you know? And then if you meet someone like me who still says similar words, but has different energy, you don't always have the discernment to read the energy as a good energy, as a desirable energy. You don't.
Because you've never experienced it. This is a completely, so the only thing you latch onto is the parts that are familiar.
Yes. And so then you go like, if this is coming as love, then this is a distorted love. So I know this will come with pain too, because they don't know how to see these two things as they don't always have to go together. There are people who can practice engaging in relations with you where the love and pain are not paired together. And that's hard. That's a super hard thing, you know, and the trust that if I build with my students, I need to take time. I tell them, like, take my classes. First, take my classes, then decide if you want to work with me, you know? And then in terms of like external client work that I do with consulting with students across, students and faculty across, that's another thing I say, like, are you comfortable? Can you accept this? Are you ready to accept this? And a lot of them have seen my lives and things, and they have a sense of me. So they're approaching me versus me approaching them, you know? And then we can have those conversations, but I still think it takes time. It takes time to say, like, did I make the right choice with this person? Is this person going to hurt? And some of the times, like, so most of my people come to me to do some sort of academic work, you know, some sort of writing work, and writing is self-expression. So it's not ever about the technocratic work of typing things on a computer, because everybody knows how to do that. So this expression, this self-expression in the most free, critical, creative way, maybe like it's the first time they're doing this work, you know, this way, and they don't have a prior model where self-expression hasn't come with harm for them or danger for them.
Right. Yeah, I'm thinking about how what you're essentially offering, which is similar to what I do, is offering the experience, possibly, likely, most probably for the first time for many, of secure love. It is an experience, and you have to live it to know it in the body, for the body to sort of rewire those wonky connections over time and start trusting that it's okay. You can say no, you can have a different opinion, right? I will not leave you or abandon you for being different. We don't have to be the same. We don't have to agree on everything. I might put out ideas that you can choose to riff on or not, right? You don't have to take care of my feelings.
Right.
You don't have to seek my approval, right? So the experience of unconditional secure attachment, with the caveat that I am also allowed to be messy, imperfect, and human in the process. So, you know, you as the teacher or the coach or the whatever, do not get pedestalized and idolized, because that is also probably in the old script. Right? That's why you have to obey, because there is a hierarchy and there is a fear and there's an idolization of the adult, of the superior, of the elder.
And I have that, you know, when you grow up, you're supposed to learn a secure attachment, like cognitively in the early years, if you grow up in a functional family, in a well-balanced family, you will learn secure attachment. And so you will learn love without the pairing of it with distorted other things. If you don't get that, then your secure attachment is to the pain.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't get that, that is the secure attachment that you have. That is the one that you have poured all your energy in neutralizing, ingesting, healing, whatever. You could have developed a whole identity around that without realizing that that is what you have done. Whether to resist that, whether to neutralize it, whether to manage relationships from that place, you have a full-on wholeness based on that attachment to that distorted love or that pain. So when you're working with me and we start talking about it, you know, even if I offer you the most loving thing, it could be received as a distorted thing, because you would only think like, this is coming to me, but this isn't exactly what I think it is, because that doesn't exist. So you giving me all this freedom to be me and to be safe, that's the illusion. What's real is that this is entangled with something else that I don't know yet. And you're going to become somebody horrible to me. You're going to do something. You're going to all of this, you know. I notice it on a very basic level. I notice it on like very like archetypical level in my class. When I teach, I've taken off grading. I don't even do grading. I have decided that nobody's, you know, identity as a learner is connected to a letter or a number, you know.
Great. That's so amazing.
I'm like, you are allowed to make mistakes and not be penalized for making mistakes. You are allowed to take risks in your work and not be penalized if the risk didn't work out. You do not have to be perfect the first time you submit something to me, you know? So you get feedback and you get to be agentic on that feedback, what you keep and what you don't. And even then there's no penalty. And folks still don't trust me. Folks think like maybe at the end of the semester, at the final assignment, I'm coming for that. That's when I'm really coming for them. When I finally have to assign the grade, I'm coming for them. So I have to tell them I'm not coming for you ever. I'm not penalizing you ever. You will not be penalized by me. I am partnering with you to, you know, to learn together, but I'm not your penalizer. I'm your learning partner. I'm your top partner. You know, I'm partnering with you. I'm not penalizing you. And I'm going to say there are times though, however, because you're going to learn something new, it's not going to come very naturally to you because there's going to be a curve. In those moments, I don't want you to think that you are not good enough or I am not good enough. You know, neither of those two things are true in those moments when we're learning something new and we have a curve to go through. And I will give you all the compassion and grace you need. And I want that to be a reciprocal relationship between the two of us. So yeah, I mean, I'm just like normalizing our messiness to say like, listen, we're messy. We're going to remain messy. None of us are that enlightened to, you know, to come out with all the perfect words and insights and ideas or anything like that. Yeah.
That must be such an amazing experience for you to witness people going through this, you know, in their own way, kicking, screaming, resisting, doubting, fearing, and still, you know, the whip doesn't land and the grades don't drop and there's no penalty, there's no penalization, like every step of the way, I imagine. I mean, I also look at things from a nervous system and biology standpoint. So I do IFS with nervous system, kind of brain rewiring and nervous system resetting, because we are so hardwired from an early age to expect this one thing that we don't know any other. We don't know how to rest.
No, we don't. Right?
Because our systems don't know. They've never experienced it. So rest can feel like a threat. Freedom can feel like a threat.
Yeah.
Right? When people who have been in institutionalized confinement for a very long time, right? This is like a classic scene from all the movies. They leave with their little package of stuff 20 years later. And that scene is always so desolate.
Yeah.
They have nowhere to go. They're just walking down this barren road away from this institution that has been their safety and home and pain and prison for the better part of their life. And they have no clue of how to handle it. Many of them end back up inside because it's what they know, right? Yeah. That is replicated in so many relationships outside of those institutions.
Yeah. I've had students that told me, I literally had students that told me like, this is the first time we have this much freedom. We don't know what to do with it. We never had it, you know? It reminds me of Shawshank Redemption, where they talk about that, you know?
I was thinking exactly that scene. You read my mind. That was the scene I would see in my mind. That end scene's like, what do I do with the freedom? And all of it at once, right? I was talking about this the other day, where I think it was in the context of like type A people, and I now identify as neurodivergent, which makes a lot of sense because my brain finally can do the thing it was designed to do instead of being like, you know, blinkered and narrow, which has its place, like linear thinking, like in a tunnel, you can keep going forever if the tunnel doesn't end. But if there's a block in front and you don't know anything outside of the walls of the tunnel, you don't know where to go from there, right? You get completely stuck. And if you're given, like, suddenly the blinkers are open and you have a 360 degree view of the ocean and you're like, oh my God, I'm alone in the middle of the ocean. I have no idea what to do with this freedom at all. What are my choices here? What are the pros and the cons? Who are the good guys? Who are the bad guys? What's coming for me? How long does this last? Is it going to get taken away? Does it cost a lot? Like, overwhelm, cue overwhelm, anxiety, and complete, like, freeze and shutdown response.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the other part of our community and many other communities as well is how have we understood our own deservedness towards help? You know, like, can we ask for help? I'm not talking about the things that we do go for help, like medical issues and things. Even then, I'm just talking about, like, we are expected as women, you know, we're expected to be the caretakers of all. You know, at the cost of sacrificing our wellness, like always at with this discourse of sacrifice being there, you have to sacrifice for your community, you have to sacrifice for your relationships, for your husband, spouse, you know, mm-hmm. partner, children, whatever, community, all of this. And so we have to then cultivate this fiercely independent identity, which is still a trauma response.
Mm-hmm.
Don't need help. I can take
don't
care
need
of
help.
Mm-hmm. I can take care of all of this. Don't need help. Help is for people who are too weak. And mm-hmm. I'm not that weak. I am strong. So there's this strong woman archetype that makes you erase your own needs. And then the world mirrors it back because you're exuding that. I don't have needs. You can do whatever to me. I'm a strong woman. But except you're very tender inside.
Yeah.
You know, you're super tender and you haven't attended to that tenderness. And then when people are shitting on you, it's the tender part that's affected and continuously getting affected and eroded. And you know it hurts. So then you're acting out in different ways. And if you are not, and you're like the queen of repression, then you're going to have autoimmune disease.
Yes, I was going to say that it comes back into the body. It's either, yeah, it comes out in your relationships, it comes out in your professional life somehow, it comes out somatically, yeah, in the body, right? Yeah. There's different
cancer,
ways. Inflammation of all kinds. I had all of these things. Yeah.
Me too. Not the cancer part, but everything else inflammation related. And then the other thing I found out is that living with that, growing up with that level of stress and cortisol in your body, you know, from a nervous system perspective, mm-hmm. eventually creates insulin resistance.
Woke up this morning, finally again, knowing, right? I've been like, this has been the elephant in the room for me. I'm like, it's been happening. The insulin resistance has been getting worse and worse, right? And I haven't been doing things to take care of it, but this is okay. Then I look back, right? I'm like, I don't have to beat up on myself for not doing all the things at once. I've had a tremendous amount of change, yeah, and growth of all kinds that's happened. And today I felt like, I feel like my body is saying, okay, we are terrified and we feel ready and open to go to the place where we connect back to the body. Because I have many dissociative parts still. Like, I think I'm a great coach and I can talk a lot about self-love. And with the understanding that nobody has it dialed in perfectly. Like, I'm not some kind of perfect model of it. I have certain pieces figured out that I think a lot of people struggle with. And it's important for me to be transparent about my own, like,
yeah,
challenges and places where, like, I'm like, huh, where will I focus now? And sometimes I just want to not be doing work all the time, self-work all the time. Like, that's crazy also.
No, the body is important. And I, you know, only started paying attention to it because it screamed at me last year.
Yeah.
It just screamed at me and said, if you don't pay attention, you cannot live the life you want to live. You know, you cannot have limbs. You cannot have your brain. You cannot have eyesight. How do you like me now? You know,
it screams loud when it screams, and it comes for us, right?
Your body does not lie. Your body does not lie. So I have realized, like, a lot of my meditation practice is so somatic, you know, and I've been cultivating a very somatic meditation practice now. Because your body doesn't lie. Your mind can tell you lots and lots of stories, but your body, you will know it. Your system is going to react a certain way, and if you tune well into it, you can do all the things that are good for your body, you know. And go ahead.
Yeah, no, I'm just thinking how, like, growing up, there was this, you know, the message, you hear this in it's in the atmosphere of, like, listen to your body. And I never understood what that meant. It didn't land with me because I even now have kind of a mixed connection to my physicality. It's come and gone. When I've been in more active, like physically active stages of my life, there's definitely more of a connection. But overall, like, the whole listen to the body thing made no sense to me. And now it makes sense that it made no sense because I have dissociating parts, rightfully so, because my body was not a safe place to be many times over and over again. Just like we talked about these scripts that were learned, right? So we've got dissociated parts that bring us straight into our head, which is a safe place. We can go to the past, we can go to the future in our minds. And the body kind of, it's still taking in information all the time, but we're not connected to that. And so when we say, feel around, you know, feel, what does it feel like in your body? Like, I have no idea what you're talking about. And I was good at making up stuff, so I could make up stuff. What does your somatic meditation practice look like? Like, what does that involve? What is it? What do you do?
A lot of focusing on breath and body, to just, you know, tap into different parts of the body, you know, and to really connect to that part, you know, like you can take a breath and then you can, like, work through everything in your body, and you can look at, like, where are you feeling tension? Where are things happening in your body? And just continuously working with that part in the meditation, you know, listening to your body to understand what needs healing, you know, where is your stress located, or where is your energy blocked in your body? And if you start working with breath and then tuning into your body, you will know, not, it doesn't have to be a physical pain. It can be an energetic pain, like, you know, and you can just guide yourself through a body scan kind of stuff. And then think about, I mean, feel it in your body. And then you'll know, like, as you're going through, ooh, that part's either physically tight or emotionally tight or spiritually tight or energetically tight. And you can begin to just send a lot of, you know, energy and love to that, but also hear what it wants you to, you know, like, so for example, like, lately I have known that my body has said to me, when it's the afternoon and you have an hour and you're sitting there trying to figure out one other thing to do, I want you to just go up and move whatever, move, dance, move, walk, move whatever way you want to move. That is not a time when you're that stressed from the heaviness of the day, but you're trying to get something else squeezed in into that 1 hour so you could be ahead of whatever. My body, like, through these meditations, my body has given me clear instruction. Move.
Wow.
Move it out. You know, so now I have this sort of, like, need to go move because I've rewired movement with releasing stress, movement with letting it go, movement with holding on to, letting go stories that I'm holding on to, you know, some movement with letting go of pain, movement with all of this other stuff. And it's very psychosomatic because, you know, I was listening to my body and my body's like, if you stay stuck in one place and you're trying to figure out something when you're physically stuck in one place, how are you going to create inspiring ideas from that place of stuckness, from that same place?
It's actual physical stuckness. Like, you're literally physically stuck in a place. So we take it literally. When you move the energy, like moving your body around. I'm feeling my limbs right now, right?
Yeah, because I'm physically stuck in front of a desk. It's the pandemic. I'm doing everything. We spend way more time in front of computers now than we did before. And so I'm physically stuck and I'm trying to work another thing in to my day because I got an hour window. So let me do this. But I'm stuck. My energy is not flowing anymore because I've been at this for the last 6 hours. So my energy is not flowing anymore. Our bodies are not supposed to be stuck in one place physically at that time. So my body is like, you move. Whatever it is you're trying to do, you will do it better if you move.
There have been so many studies and, you know, just anecdotal evidence of people who get their best ideas while they're driving, while they're walking, while they're cycling, while they're running, while they're in the shower, while they're doing something physical, maybe not the driving so much, but, like, you know, It's a different part of the brain when you're moving. Now you're inspiring me.
You have a somatic way to create presence, you know, because it's hard to go like, just be present in the moment. Just be present in the moment. But what does that mean when people say present in the moment? Like, what does that mean? Because we're neurotic. We either think shit that happened to us or shit that will happen to us.
Right. Past and future. That's where the brain wants to go. I had this insight recently, which is like the best way that I have noticed for me. Meditation for me does not look like sitting on a cushion. But it's lying in the bath. It's being in the kitchen.
Yeah.
It's making music 100%. Because I do improvised music too. So it's like, it's really, you have to be very present. And other like physical activities, right? Like exercise, sex, like things like that are very body focused things. Yeah. And so the best way to become present, because again, the body cannot go forward or back in time. So if you engage with the body, you are automatically
present.
More present.
Yeah.
Automatically.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Doing yoga, stretching, you know, walking on the grass, bare feet, like laughing. Touching things, laughing, making sounds, right?
Yeah. So like when I start walking, I'm way more present than, you know, I'm sitting here. Now that doesn't mean that my brain is not going and thinking through everything. You know, it is probably, but I'm also present with each step. I'm present in my body to do the thing that means I walk around the block and come back home. So in doing that, I cultivate an awareness to say like, hey, what are you thinking in this walk? What are you noticing in this walk? You know, what is coming up for you in this walk? Do you need to park your energy at this issue? Or can this issue be something you table for later? So I can have those dialogues with myself, and then a bunch of different thoughts will come on and say, pay attention to me, pay attention to me, pay attention to me. And I'm like, okay, all right, I will do this, but not that. You know, it just gives me movement and flexibility. And I feel like I now have the whole world as my computer, thought computer.
It is. I mean, we are in.
And I'm going, all you all go away. I'm going to sit on this bench and listen to the bird chirps for a few minutes before I do anything else. So I'll just sit quietly for like maybe even 5 minutes, just listening to ambient sounds, birds chirping, wind blowing, leaves rustling, people walking by talking, cars driving. And even just doing that for 5 minutes, it's like, whew, for five was minutes.
Was it excruciating at first to do that? I imagine for people coming out of like, right, like hustle culture and grind culture, like slowing down for even a minute is like terrifying. Listen, not saying you were in that.
No. That was me too. And I have ADHD. So it's super hard. But actually, you know, the flip side of the superpower of ADHD is you can become hyper-focused when you want to be hyper-focused, you know? And so if my hyper, and plus I'm super goal-oriented, so if I give myself a goal of not having a goal, then that is my goal. Your goal is to not have a goal of doing anything other than sitting down and just listen. That is your goal. You do not do anything with it. It doesn't turn into coaching. It doesn't turn into self-work. It doesn't turn into something you can teach somebody. It is only for no purpose. Your goal is no purpose. Sit and listen. That is your goal. So once I give myself the goal, I'm like, okay, I will just do that, you know? And then I do that for 5 minutes. Sometimes it's a little more. And then I'm like, oh, that was nice, you know? It's a super cool unplug. And I've given my students that activity, and the activity is do something for 5 minutes a day where you're only doing that one thing and nothing else, just the one thing. It cannot be listening to a podcast. So you cannot do this while you're listening to me. So go do it after you listen to the podcast. So it cannot be that, but it can be like, maybe you're just eating something. Maybe you're having breakfast. So just do that for 5 minutes without distraction, without scrolling on the phone, without looking at the TV, without taking care of kids, dogs, pets, whatever. 5 minutes for yourself. If you're struggling to do that 5 minutes when there are other people around, when you are driving, pause at the side of the road and just go 5 minutes. I would give people just 5 minutes. Take 5 minutes out to do absolutely nothing other than just one thing. One thing, And you can also be like a Twilight character and just stare at nothing for 5 minutes with no expression. You can be that, be a Twilight character. Twilight doesn't, Twilight, the movie series, you know? And I cannot tell you how many times people have said how hard that has been for them.
Right.
How super hard that has been for them to just do. So then I remember one student goes, oh, I haven't done Buenos Aires 5 minutes today. So like I pull over and they pull over and there was like a windmill in the field. This was in Kansas. Okay, so then I stared at the windmill for 5 minutes because then I did Buenos Aires assignment for 5 minutes. Yeah.
That sounds great.
That's awesome. I'm like, I'm glad you took it that seriously. I love it, you know? But it's like, why is it so hard for you to do something for yourself for 5 minutes without doing anything else? And people still in my coaching space too, my clients, other faculty, other students say, that is so hard to do. I'm like, I want you to do for 5 minutes. And I work with women of color, people of color, and they're always sacrificing their lives for somebody else, you know? And this is the one indulgent thing I want them to do for themselves. 5 minutes, 5 minutes, take time out of your day for 5 minutes. And that's hard.
This to me speaks, I mean, this is a big part of what I'm interested in and talk about. And I feel like I kind of dodged a bullet in that sense, because even though I don't know how I identify, but I'm definitely diasporic of some kind. I was born in the US, raised in India. I was here again back in the US for 10 years, and I was in India for almost 10 years, and I've been here now almost 10 years. So it's like, I don't even know where I belong. I look like I'm from anywhere, right? So I'm really like one of those like freaks of the edge. But the good part is that having grown up a good deal in India, where we, at least at the time, we didn't have the kind of hustle culture that I see a lot of people needing to undo for themselves here in the West, right? If anything, there's like a little bit of a laissez-faire kind of attitude, right? So it's like finding that in between where one can be ambitious and be, you know, have big goals and dreams. I don't know about goals, but like just big dreams. I have creative dreams and big visions. But without that insane, intense kind of self-erasing pressure that comes with it constantly. So there's like, as a society, we've been programmed, especially as women of color, as Desis, if we are, especially if we're in partnerships or other kind of familial, or community things, that it is our job and role to take care of everybody else, to take care of everybody's feelings, everybody else's needs, et cetera. And our self-worth has become so tied up in that, that stopping that, right, unhitches. I mean, it doesn't unhitch right away. So stopping one makes the other one, puts the other one in question. Like, what am I worth if I stop for 5 minutes to look at a windmill? Who am I? Right. And then there's a whole other layer of scripts that come in. Am I selfish, indulgent, a bad partner, a bad parent, a bad person to stop and take 5 minutes? How dare I? Who am I to do such a thing? Then all the other things, this is not productive. It is not useful. It is not making money. It is not, you know, serving my child. It is not getting the dinner on the table. Like all of those lists of things come up.
Yep. I've even had people say, and how does that help me publish my papers? Like, it has to have some sort of something. Like, I don't know. It does.
It is a cult of productivity. I mean, there is a culture of productivity.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Which when you go in other parts of the world, you know, the Europeans laugh at this.
Yeah. It's
a long-standing joke, right? Like if you write to someone in Europe at an office or a business or something at the beginning of the summer, they're like, we're gone till September. You can email us then. And the, you know, American corporate culture is like, I'm going to have kidney surgery. I'll have my phone on and I'll be out in 2 hours. So my email response might be slightly delayed. I'll be bleeding out here on the operating table, but I'll get back to you right away. It's crazy. Yes.
It's crazy. There's this one person that I buy some stuff from Etsy, and she's in Canada and she's French. And she literally writes there, "It is rude of you to email me after these hours and in between these hours. I do not follow the US North American culture of productivity. I will only answer emails between this time and this time. Please do not email me and make my system, like make my phone send me notifications on emails when you are. And if you choose, if you continue this pattern and impose this on me, you know, I will turn my phone off and you will still not get any response." Like, she says this out loud. "It's super rude for you to do all of these things to me and expect me to be available to you to respond to you any time of the day."
it's pretty nuts. It's nuts. I love that. That's hilarious. I love that your Etsy person is doing that.
Yeah, no, it's super cool. You know, I've done something else too with my training and class as well. I do like a end of class retreat over like 2 or 3 days. And because the timing of that is quite a substantive amount of time, so that when we have a regularly scheduled class, I create like rest times, you know, once a month, it's a rest time. And I beg and plead them. No one knows that this is rest other than you and me, you know. Everybody knows that at this time you have to be in class. Can you take this time for yourself and do absolutely nothing for anybody else but for you? That can be napping. That can be just going out and to a restaurant and having a meal. That can be reading a book that has nothing to do with your academic work. That can be painting, singing, or doing totally nothing. So I have like a day in a month built in as a rest day for my class. All things that in the space that I'm in, the academic space that I'm in, they don't really encourage that. Academia, like many other places of employment, is a hungry beast. And it's never satiated. You give and it'll still ask you for more because it wants you to feel that you're not enough. So whatever you did this time, you have to do more the next time and then more the next time. So you have no finish line to go and accomplish, and you're always not enough. Like, you live with this thing of not being enough. Yeah. And academia is not only placed. I mean,
yeah,
this is a global archetype. Like, lots of people benefit if the people working for you think that they're not enough.
Exactly. I mean, this is where I get on my other soapbox. I'm like, who benefits, right? Think about who benefits.
Yeah.
And you are now participating it yourself. They don't even have to do it.
No,
you have to live with yourself. You are self-flagellating 24/7 now. You've learned how to do it. They've taught you well. And now you do it to yourself. You walk into the room and you start apologizing for yourself and excusing for your existence straight away. Nobody has to do it for you.
Yeah. And then you discipline each other and judge each other in that way too. They're lazy. They're not productive, you know, all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
What a hoot. Well, I am very grateful you're in the world. I am thrilled that you're doing this very important work and the non-work components of the work. We should call this episode Lazy.
Lazy.
I want to
lazy conversations.
I want to reclaim lazy as a benevolent word, as a powerful word. Like, you have the balls and the guts and the daring to be lazy.
Yeah.
Be lazy for 5 minutes a day.
Lazy chai chai.
Yeah. We have that in our culture too. We can reclaim that long, timeless time pass tease, you know. We forgot all that in our pursuit of perfect bodies and designer jeans and whatever the hell else, you know, big fat paychecks and second homes and bigger cars and all that shit that just doesn't go, it doesn't die with you.
No.
You know,
no.
I'm going to die with myself. I'm feeling great about my life right now.
Yeah. A life well lived is far more precious than any of the other things.
Right?
Although I wouldn't mind a house overlooking beautiful lake and a mountain simultaneously. I would love that. I'm dreaming that for my family, you know.
Yeah, we get to dream. Yeah, the place it comes from matters, right? It comes from compulsion. It's different than like from vision and dreaming. It's like, that's exciting. You get to dream and you get to create from dreams. That's delicious. What fun. Such different energy. I love you so much, Queen Bee. Thank you for being here.
Big, big, I love you. Love you. I love you. I
love
you.
We love each other. We are love. Lovers.
Lots of love. Thank you for having me. This was so much fun chatting without an agenda.
See, this was your little break built into your day. Forced aimless chatter.
Listen, and I did have chai while I was working with you or talking to you.
I had my little cup. There you go.
Awesome. All right. Awesome. Are we stopping?
Yeah. We can pause here.
Do you edit these?
Hey, if you're just starting to discover that you are a resentful, exhausted, overwhelmed people pleaser, you are welcome to my weirdo family. Go to my website, www.reinajhaveri.com. Yes, you will have to spell that, RAYNAJHAVERI.com, and get on my mailing list. I will see you in your inbox. And we're going to learn how to say yes to yourself and no to other people with a big, fat, open heart. I love you, and I'll talk to you soon.